are you doing today?
Hey, did you catch the meteor shower last night? I went out with Deborah, my friend, and we sat under the stars and watched the meteors fly by. We actually went up to the hills of Oakland. I live in the Bay Area here, San Francisco Bay Area in Oakland, and up in the Oakland Hills is the Chabot Space Center, and they actually have a couple of telescopes there. And the big shower was Friday morning at between 2 and 5 a.m., but I couldn't stay up that late. So we went Friday night. Thursday night was the big one. Friday night was the or Friday morning was the big one, but Friday night into Saturday morning, there was additional showers, and we had a chance to see some of them. And man, that's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to watch those go by. Some of them were like big flashes in the sky, big movements of these meteors. The real cool thing, though, is we had a chance to look through one of the telescopes, and this big monstrous telescope weighs about 4,000 pounds and is set in this dome, was pointed at to one of these star clusters, and we had a chance to actually see it. As they were positioning the telescope to view this area, and wow, the whole gyrations to get the telescope in position, the moving of the dome, it was kind of cool. I hadn't seen that before. And we were both kind of going, we were like little kids going, God, look at that. Wow. It was a lot of fun. Anyhow, we were up there between, I think it was 10:30 to about 11:15. And we stood in line and we watched, we looked at the telescope, never done that before. And then we were directed to, you know, to a section of the lawn outside next to the observatories where we could watch these streaming meteors. And boy, it was cool. A lot of people stayed. They kind of kicked everybody out after 10:30, excuse me. And, but it was cool. If you ever get a chance to see those, I guess they come by the meteor showers come by every August, and they're really quite a spectacle. Kind of cool to watch. It's getting to be that time of year too. You know, things are it's warm. It's summer's in its full flow. But it's also getting close to Oktoberfest time. The end of the last 2 weeks of September, the first 2 weeks of October. And I was reminded that I have a group called, I think you all know I'm into the micro beers, the micro brews, the craft brews, those handmade jewels that are out there. And we have a big Oktoberfest here. I didn't know it, but Oakland was settled by German immigrants. And I am the offspring of a German immigrant. My grandfather came from Germany. In his day, he was leaving to get away from the First World War. So Oktoberfest is a big deal. And when I was a kid, I wore lederhosen. And then as an adult, I really got into it. And I wear lederhosen too. So it's like time to pull the lederhosen out. It's lederhosen time. Or dinderels, if you're a woman, you wear those fancy dresses. But it's getting that time. And so I was reminded I'm setting up the group for Oktoberfest by the Bay, which is a monstrous event here in the West Coast. They have it in San Francisco, and it's so big that they have it in one of the piers, the big ship docking piers. And they have 3 days of celebration, and each day from like 6 to midnight, they fill the hall with 5,000 people. So my small group, I think we have a couple hundred people to go, but a lot of people wear their lederhosen, wear their German outfits. And I was just reminded about that. You know, I was going, uh-oh, it's getting close again. So, and in the old days, And probably, and I, from my, I haven't been to Munich to do the traditional Oktoberfest. They drink lager, which is a very light beer. Budweiser's lager, Miller, Budweiser, Miller, Coors, those are all lagers. But now they have these really good Oktoberfest beers. Those are very flavorful. And they have dark, they have almond nut brew and things like that. So Oktoberfest is here. Wow. It's getting close, I should say. Got to get all the stuff out. Get ready for the party. A few notes on the Facebook page. I wrote an article called Ancient Central American Floods, Destruction at Chichen Itza. And as you know, in the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about floods around the world. We had Randall Carlson last week go extensively into floods, plains, what the floods did. I believe that there were similar floods, not as destructive, because there's much flatter land in Yucatan Peninsula and in parts of Mexico where I have evidence of floods. But there is evidence of floods. And this article I wrote, and it's a short article, maybe 500 words, is based on a number of photographs I found from the Carnegie Institute. Now, in the 1920s, at the turn of the century, 1910, 1920s, the Institutes of America were the ones who were doing the great excavations. They excavated in South America, and they excavated quite significantly throughout Mexico. And what I didn't know is that they got in there in 1927 when Chichen Itza, Uxmal, and most, if not all, of the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico was covered in mud and dirt and rubble. And only because of the local natives were they able to identify mounds as pyramids, mounds as complexes, buildings, and other ruined buildings. And these photographs that I posted, which is part of this article, reveal that these buildings were not simply pushed down or the wind blew them down. Some terrific devastation took place. And I focus specifically on the building known as the Caracol, which is the Spanish for the snail. And the snail is the observatory. And the observatory is where the Maya would look up into the sky and, you know, chart the heavens and calculate. And what's fascinating is what we see in these photographs is what this building, this observatory, looked like before they began to excavate and reconstruct this huge site. It's been destroyed by water. There's no other way to explain it. You see piles and piles of sand. You see stonework. Now, remember, the Maya use very strong and sophisticated cements. And these buildings are put up with cement. And they are not small blocks. Some of these blocks weigh, you know, thousands of tons. And what would knock that down? Is anyone's guess, but my guess and my belief is that it was water. So check it out. The article is on Facebook. Go to Earth Ancients, go to group, and you will see it. The other news, the other story I want to post is they found probably what is considered now the oldest mummy in the Americas at a place called Carol, Peru, which is in South America. And if you don't know about this place, Carol, Peru, it has the only pyramids in South America that are monstrous. These are big, big pyramids, and they're made out of some of the base is sandstone, but they're mostly made out of mud brick. And this mummy, this noble woman, dated back to 2500 BC, which is 4,500 years old, is quite unique. She's mummified in the same kind of style you see in Egypt, and she's adorned with some semi-precious stones. And it begins to make us think about what happened, what was happening here in South and Central America that long ago. I believe that the Maya are much older than what we currently consider, which is a few thousand years old. We know now that they are contemporaries of the Olmec civilization, that meaning they lived around the same time. But I think we'll see that they are significantly older. So that article you can find on Facebook group page, and it's a pretty interesting article.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And this is pretty interesting. This came from Nature magazine this week. This is one. This is the kind of discovery that really begins to shake things up. Scientists from Denmark, Canada, and America are now showing that it was impossible for the so-called Clovis people, the Clovis civilization, to have come from the Bering Strait or Siberia. The current theory is that people entered North America from Siberia via a land bridge, a frozen land bridge, and spread in through the U.S., which is now the U.S., into Mexico, about 13,000 years ago. But this new discovery, this new evidence basically shows this couldn't have happened. There's no way it could have happened, simply because at that time frame, 13,000 years ago, there was no food, there was no animal life, there was no vegetation that would support human life. So, I mean, the whole area was covered in ice sheets. And so they you know, my education, for my kids' education, for a lot of people, the thought from anthropologists was that the Clovis people were the first culture to populate North America. So this now is wrong. The new belief, these guys believe that they traveled, these native people, these explorers, these travelers traveled via the Pacific coast. I believe that they came via the coast. If not the Chinese and these other cultures came from the coast. We've heard from natives on this program that some groups came up through Central America. So anyhow, this is huge news. You can find it on our Earth Agents page on Facebook. It's posted there under, it's actually Popular Theory on How Humans Populated North America Can't Be Right Study Shows, and that's from Nature magazine. So check that out. That's pretty significant information. So we've discussed ancient culture, Native American myths. We've talked about myths in Europe. We actually have talked about myths in different parts of the world, but getting to the heart of myths has been the question that's been challenging to answer, because myths seem to be a challenge to understand because it's hard to take them literally, or are they vague references to things that have happened in the past? We don't know. My guest today, David Matheson, has written a number of very, very interesting books. His first book was a study of myths in ancient world called Star Myths of the World. His other book is The Undying Star. The Star Myths of the World is volume 1s and 2. And they get into a lot of detail on what myths are all about. David, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, no, we're living in a physical and spiritual world at the same time. So some wire might have been crossed in there.
Yeah, so you were saying about the shower, that it was kind of a nice connection to what we're moving into here this morning on our program. But the thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah. No, I mean, I my girlfriend was mentioning this to me, and I was like, let's go out. She's like, go check the school. We should go check that out. I'm like, really? You know, because I just don't. I mean, I look up and I do a lot of hiking and stuff, but I'm not outside at night much at all. But what we saw was very cool. And to go up to the observatory and see the stars in crystal clarity was really fun. I don't know if you had a chance to go see the meteor shower, but it's very cool.
Yeah, I sure did. Boy, I saw one fireball that was just like left a trail of smoke. It looked like a trail of smoke across the sky for probably less than a second, but it felt like 2 seconds. I mean, you could see it going across the sky almost as if it was in slow motion, going from north to south along the eastern horizon. Was
wow.
Beautiful. So are we back live now?
Yeah.
Or are we
sure
recording? Yeah. So what I was going to say is it is a good kind of segue into the reason it's called the Perseid meteor shower, or however it's pronounced by astronomers, is because different meteor showers that are predictable have to do with where we are on our track around the sun as we're orbiting on the Earth, mm-hmm. under the model that I believe happens, which is that the Earth orbits the sun. And, you know, the different constellations are kind of like the background of the gigantic infinite room that we're in as we're going around. But if you think of the Earth going around, if you shrink it down to being inside your living room or your dining room where you have your dining room table, the constellations would be on all the walls as well as on the ceiling and the floors. Now, obviously, that's not the way. They're infinite, and the constellations aren't flat. They're composed of stars that are all different distances from us. But if you think of it as if we're in our room, you know, going around the sun, where we are on that track, we'll see different images on different walls. Like at one time of year, we might be looking at the south wall, so to speak, and another time of year, we might be looking at the west wall of our room. Mm-hmm. And so where we are on that track, when we go through a cloud of dust that's there all the time because it was left by a comet, for instance, the Orionid meteor shower was actually is thought to be or has been shown to be the dust trail from Halley's Comet. You know, I don't know mm-hmm. if you've ever seen Halley's Comet. I remember
I've seen pictures of it. Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's huge.
Yeah, we went out. I remember going out and trying to see it when I was, I guess, 15 or 16 or whenever it was here, and it looked basically like a star. We were looking at it with binos. But that trail of that comet where it crosses Earth's orbital path leaves dust. And so when we come to that point on our journey each year, we're going through that trail. We see all these objects burning up in our atmosphere. So the Perseid meteor shower being one of the best ones, you look kind of in the direction of Perseus, the constellation that's on the wall.
Right.
Tells us where we are. It's always around August 11th and 12th. So it tells us where we are on our track, but we're going to always encounter these dust particles from a different comet, not Halley's Comet, at that time of year and get this spectacular meteor shower. At least that's the conventional explanation, which, as far as I know, is correct. But it gets us to the constellation Perseus, and the fact that Perseus is a constellation who shows up in many different myths. In fact, he's one of the rare constellations that actually has a myth with his own name, Perseus, the myth of Perseus. He's the one who rescues Andromeda and fights some dreadful, dreadful creatures that he's sent to his adversaries. Do you know who they are? Do you remember? Perseus.
Perseus, that was it Hades, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I don't know if you remember, like, the Clash of the Titans. Remember in the 70s? I don't know how old you are.
Yeah.
In the 70s, that Clash of the Titans was the Perseus legend, basically, with a lot of, artistic license thrown in. But he's the one who had to go retrieve. He had to go to the Gorgons, and encounter Medusa who turns
Medusa,
everyone to stone.
Medusa, the snake-headed gal, yeah.
Exactly,
you look,
exactly.
You look at
actually,
her, you turn to stone.
Yes, she was a beautiful maiden, you see, but she was transformed into a monster, which we can get into kind of the spiritual meaning of these myths, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. What I was just going to say is Perseus, with his long tangent, I'm trying to connect it back to where we are on our solar track, and if anyone's in a meteor shower. The Perseus legend is related to the Perseus constellation, and he's right next to Andromeda in the sky, and also there's a sea monster in the story, and there's a sea monster in the sky right next to Perseus. So that's a myth where it's actually very clear that it's based on the constellations. And, you know, we could argue, well, which came first? You know, well, there was this myth, and then later people said, oh, let's call these constellations after that myth.
Before we get into the meat of this, I have to ask you, this is a very complex subject, simply because we're talking about different cultures around the world with their mythology, and then how it relates to the cosmos, the universe, and what we see at night. And you found a tremendous amount of parallels. But I guess what I want to ask you to start the program is, what got you started in this? What was the premise? What was the trigger that got you, David, involved in something that is very complex but also has a lot of rewards, because you find some fascinating parallels?
Yeah, thank you. Good question, and it's good to I appreciate your guiding the conversation, and I'll try and answer nice and directly to what you're asking. So, like anything else, there's a lot of inputs into how I got to where I am. It's kind of like asking, you know, how did you end up with the person that you married? Well, I was born on a sunny day, and go through the whole thing. It's almost like this information is coming to me from another world. If I wanted to say the short answer, it's like, whoa, I wasn't out looking for this. But it does, I can trace it back to interests I had when I was very young. So what I would say is the short answer, I can't take credit for this information. There's other people who have talked about this subject. Plato, Macrobius, going back thousands of years, Aristotle, they've talked about it in bits and pieces, not really necessarily extensively or systematically. But when I was young, my dad got me, even before, I can't even remember a time before I had these books, but I had the books of H.A. Ray, and you may be familiar. You may be scratching your head, wait, that name sounds familiar, but it doesn't sound like he's in the Graham Hancock kind of circles. Wait a minute, that's the guy who wrote Curious George. Well, that's right. So in the 50s, H.A. Ray put out a book called The Stars, A New Way to See Them. And it's a fantastic book that belongs in everybody's house. Go out and get it right now if you don't have it. 1952 was the first edition, but it's like in its 14th edition now.
Mm-hmm.
And he was lamenting the lack of familiarity that people have with the stars, but really lamenting the system that we have of envisioning the constellations. He said, it's really terrible. There's a couple different ways that people present these things in books, and they're both awful. I'm going to give you a way that makes sense, is easy to remember, will be useful to you. And I grew up with that system. He even had a children's version of that book, which is great if you have young kids, which is, I forget what it's called, Look at the Stars is what it's called. So that's a very thin version of The Stars, A New Way to See Them. So if you have children, or, if someone wants to get a present for their grandkid, that's a good one. Anyway, long story short, I grew up envisioning the stars that way. I was raised in a, basically going to church, but not really aggressively or anything like that, and didn't really have any sort of... But later on, when I was in the Army, I became basically a literalist Christian. I was in the South, So I studied the Bible a lot. On Sundays I did nothing but read things related to the Bible, or read the Bible itself, go to mm-hmm. church. And so I'm very familiar with the Bible. Well, I've always been loved the myths. Grew up also with, you know, some of the great books by the, picture books about the myths, Greek myths, Norse myths. I heard you mentioning that your grandfather came from Germany. My grandfather came over from Norway and settled in the Bay Area. A lot of San Francisco houses were built by Norwegians in the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, 1900s, because they were good woodworkers. And a lot of the buildings are made out of, redwood trees and things that were floated up from Redwood City. So Norse myths, of course, because in my Norwegian background, were fascinating to me. So I love the myths. Well, later on, after I got out of the Army, I encountered a book called Hamlet's Mill, which was published in 1969. A lot of people have referred to this book. Graham Hancock refers to it a lot. They're the ones who talk about procession as being encoded in a lot of mythology. And they touch on all kinds of different myths and say, I think the myths of the world are kind of like a vast ruined architecture, this vast worldwide architecture that's encoding advanced, sophisticated understanding of the world and the heavens and other things. They don't really get into spiritual, but they say this seems to be, this might relate to Sirius, the star, or, they don't really give you a systematic layout. They give you hints, and actually there's some places where, I disagree with some of their conclusions now, later on, having really dived into this. But that just fascinated me, and I started looking at how, this could apply to the myths. And what was troubling to me was they would apply it to the stories of the Bible as well, and I was very familiar with the stories of the Bible and with the stars. And so when they started to show that, I said, it actually makes some sense when they say that Samson grabbed this jawbone, and right next to Orion, there's a jawbone-shaped constellation in the sky. And by the way, we also have heroes using a jawbone as a weapon, not just in the Bible, but in the myths of New Zealand or Aotearoa. The Maori have myths of a hero who uses the jawbone, actually, of his grandmother as a weapon.
Right.
We have myths in South America of a hero who uses the jawbone of a tapir, which is, when it's like, not the capybaras, but a tapir, large kind of animal. Well, he used the jawbone. What's up with all these jawbones? And they said, but it's because next to Orion, we have this beautiful V-shaped constellation called the Hyades. It's very bright. It contains the star Aldebaran, very bright orange star. It's a distinctive V in the sky. It's not far from Orion. In fact, you had on Gary Evans, I think, was talking about the centrality of Orion and Hopi.
Yeah,
and
he's
Lakota.
Very much focused on Orion. Yeah, and that's Native
and that's
America.
Absolutely, and they had a cycle of the year where, so you find these myths all around the world have these similar patterns. For instance, the use of a jawbone as a weapon. And, as someone who was taking the Bible literally, that was a little bit problematic because I said, wait a minute, didn't Samson really use a jawbone? I mean, if Samson didn't really use a physical jawbone, that's a problem if I'm trying to take the Bible literally.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe he used the jawbone and everybody else copied that myth, or maybe all these myths, including the stories in the Bible, are based on the motions of the stars. So I can stop there and you can ask
that's pretty.
You want,
that's pretty amazing. No, that's pretty amazing. Let's get back to the motion of the stars in a second. But I want to start with one question, and I think it runs through your books routinely, and that is, it looks that like you have found that these myths are actually a language encoded in this, some kind of a form of information left by ancient people. Would you say that's a too generalized a statement to be made, or would you say that that's kind of a encapsulates what you've discovered, that these ancient cultures were very tuned into cosmic events, cosmic patterns, and who knows where they came from, but it seems like there's a commonality among different people around the world in the ancient past that is all somewhat similar.
Oh, absolutely. So there's a lot in that question in how you said it. So a code, just as if we're writing code, right? You're there in Silicon Valley. Some people write code. Mm-hmm. Some people are really experts at writing code.
Yeah.
Is a language. A language is a code. Well, the stars, let me say it a different way. The myths are speaking to us in a language. And the question is it a literal language? Some people interpret it as if they're speaking a literal language about literal historical personages. Well, Samson, you know, if we just dug in the right place, we might find that jawbone, that very jawbone that Samson used, or maybe, you know, maybe it has dissolved, but maybe we can find the outline of where that jawbone used to be. That would be, if I'm listening to the myths in the Bible, let's say, in a literal way, if I'm interpreting them as if, well, I would do this because Samson did this, and I don't want to be like what he was, or I do want to emulate what he's doing, that's interpreting them as if they're literal. I don't believe anymore that they're speaking that language. I believe they're speaking a celestial, metaphorical language. So it's almost as if your computer runs on one OS, operating system, and you're trying to talk to it or listen to it as if it's speaking, and you only speak a different OS, or you're going to get some errors. I believe if we listen to them, it's almost as if they're speaking a language. They're coming to us. A metaphor might be someone who comes over here and they only speak Cantonese or some language that you don't speak, and none of your friends speaks it. You need to get an interpreter. And if the interpreter doesn't actually speak it either, but he pretends that he does, that person can say a bunch of things, and the interpreter can turn to you and say, he said this, or she said this. And if they're saying, if they don't really speak that language, and they're saying what they think the person said, they're going to be giving you something that might be very different from what that person's trying to say. So let me dial it back to the myth. And your question is, I think all the myths of the world are speaking a metaphorical language, not a literal language, a metaphorical language. Metaphors that are based on the stars, and they are using that as a code, like you said, to refer to other things, to spiritual truths. Also embedded in your question is, where did it all come from? And like you also said in your question, we don't necessarily know where it all came from, but the fact, if they're all around the world speaking in the same celestial language, that raises all kinds of problems with the conventional historical paradigm, because, you know, it gets into the isolationism, diffusionism, or maybe they're the remnants of something even more ancient. Not necessarily diffusionism as in some culture went around the world and spread this everywhere, but maybe all cultures of the world are descended from some even more ancient source that nobody even knows anymore that had this system, and now everyone's practicing remnants of it, and it's changed. You know, if I'm living in a tropical island in the Pacific, the outlines of this system are going to take on the outlines of my culture. If I'm living in Germania or Norway, the outlines, my system will start to look like something different, but they all have a common source and they can be shown. This isn't just speculation. I can show the stars that connect to this myth. It's very, there's a lot of evidence that you can point to.
This is what's fascinating to me, and you just hit upon it, which is somebody provided a system to encode myth, to encode this language and spread it across the world. And as you found, it's everywhere. You know, these myths have such great similarities with a little, you know, flair for each culture, cultural flowering, if you want to call that, that what you see is great evidence for the same story brought out. And then what you're saying is that you actually take it one step further, and not beyond the myth, you begin to look at the cosmos for these constellations and how they all fit together. Let's touch upon one thing that you brought up in your book, The Undying Star, which, by the way, I recommend people reading. In the book, you state that during the Roman Empire, ancient wisdom was eradicated from various myths. Why would they do that? Why would they want to remove and eradicate that information?
Well, that's a great question. So let's talk about the Undying Stars. Actually, if people want to kind of follow along, and I know, you know, there's time at the end to talk about it, but my website, starmythworld.com, has a books section, and then you can see my four books. And The Undying Stars is my second book, and it's actually after I started to realize that the Bible is not literal. So my first book, I was still operating under taking the Bible literally as I tried to explore some of the flood myths that are found around the world. So I'll get to your question. I mean, the short answer to your question, why would someone eradicate knowledge? Let's say the knowledge is like a kung fu system and you like to go around and start bar fights. You might want to eliminate the teachers of kung fu so that you're the only one who knows it. That might be one reason, let's say, for control purposes, to take away knowledge or to use, let's put it this way, some of your listeners might have been threatened with hell as a punishment. I know I was as a kid when I went to a Sunday school class one time. I remember I was probably in third grade. I was taken out into the hall by a teacher, a Sunday school, who's, I don't even remember what I was doing. I was teasing someone or something. And my back was put against the wall, and the teacher was telling me very sternly, if you do this, you could go to hell. Okay? That is a form of trying to control the behavior. Like, hey, this kid is being troublesome. I can't beat him, but I can threaten him with eternal punishment in the fires of hell. Okay? That's a useful form of control. You can bet I stopped teasing whoever I was teasing. I very dimly remember it, but some people have much more pervasive examples than that, where there's, you know, they've been silenced maybe by their whole family because of a choice they've made, and their whole family is taking a literal version. So these things are very powerful, can be used as very powerful forms of negative control, which I don't believe is what their original intention is, but you know, some people might debate me on that. What I was doing by saying people could check out kind of the scope of my books. The second book, The Undying Stars, actually is broken into three sections. The first section saying, I think this is going on. You know, what is going on? The stars. The myths of the world, including the Bible, encode the stars. Part two was, what could it mean? What could be in the Undying Stars itself? It's kind of a map. That book is kind of a map to what I've written since then as well, although it was published in 2014, so some of my understanding has, you know, changed.
Evolved.
I understand the system, I believe. I speak the language even more fluently than I did in 2014. We could say it that way. So part two of The Undying Stars, the first is, I think this is going on. Let me explain what I think is going on. Part two, this is what it could mean. all kinds of things. It could mean all kinds of things. Number three, what happened? How come we don't understand this anymore? It seems that this knowledge is actually worldwide. Look, like you've talked on your show about yoga before. Yoga is not just the postures that people do. It's a whole system. It's a whole way of life. Like Ashtanga has eight arms to it. Only one of those is the asanas or the postures. The other things have to do with not being violent to other people or not being right. too greedy with possessions, all these things. That is a whole life system. Well, I believe that these ancient cultures, in some places, that stream of ancient knowledge was not disrupted. India certainly had some disruptions from the British imperialism and colonialism mm-hmm. and, you know, horrible things that are still impacting. But some trickles of that ancient system managed to survive, or maybe a more than a trickle, maybe a great stream of, mm-hmm. and that we find that around the world, the Native American indigenous nations and peoples of the Americas had a system that was still tapped into the ancient knowledge. The ancient Egyptians had this system. The ancient Greeks, all these things taught, I believe, very similar truths about the nature of this world. Like the ancient Greeks saw a god or a goddess or a nymph in every stream, every fountain, every tree. You don't just go mm-hmm. clear-cutting trees. You have to be in tune with the universe has a spiritual mm-hmm. component, spiritual dimension.
Right.
Well, I believe the Bible has, there's very clear indication that the Bible is built on the exact same system, but that's not the way most people think of it. If you take the Bible literally, you're told, hey, their system is messed up. We have to go correct them. We have to take our knowledge over there and fix their problem because they are believing in demons or they're believing in spirits, and we got to correct their understanding. Well, that's wrong, and it's based on a wrong interpretation of what the Bible actually... The Bible is built on the same star system of metaphor that's telling us truths about the world. That's part two. What does it mean? They're all telling us similar things, like we're living in a joint material and spiritual world here. We ourselves have a material and spiritual component. Okay. And the Bible is telling you that based on star myths, just like the sacred texts of the Maya are telling you that based on star myths, just like the sacred stories of the people of the Pacific Ocean are telling you that based on spiritual stories. I found it in, you know, some of the stories in Africa, in Australia, in, you know, certainly the Norse myths. And
why don't you take a moment and give us one of these examples of similar myths, say maybe three different cultures that have myths that are very, very similar with a resulting thought. In other words, the myth, according to you, means this.
Oh, boy, that's great. Great question. I'll say the first one that pops into my mind, which is the what I would call the incomplete baptism story.
Okay.
So your readers or listeners may be saying, incomplete, what is that? Well, if you think of the hero of the Iliad, you know who the greatest warrior in the Iliad was in the Greek, you know, the Greek two mightiest epics of ancient Greece was the Iliad and the Odyssey. In the Odyssey, it mostly focuses on Odysseus. In the Iliad, it focuses on the rage and the anger of this kind of sulky, angry warrior who's the best on either side, Achilles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Achilles, famously portrayed by Brad Pitt, right?
Yeah.
In one of those, I haven't actually seen the movie. I like to.
Yeah, he's a superior warrior. He's an amazing warrior.
Yeah, he's the best warrior on either side. But he's been insulted. His pride has been insulted. So he goes and he sulks in his tent. He's not coming out. And of course, his whole side gets driven back to the ocean because they don't have Achilles. And the other side has Hector, and he's like the second most powerful warrior out there. But he knows that if he ever actually encounters Achilles face to face, he knows that Achilles is the best. If they ever played one-on-one basketball, Achilles would win. But since Achilles is sulking because he's been insulted. That's the story of the Iliad. And they don't actually get into it, but Achilles has a pretty famous other aspect of his myth. They don't. It's not part of the direct action in the Iliad. The Iliad basically starts when he goes off to sulk in his tent and ends when he kills Hector. But in part of the Achilles myth, there's lots more to the Achilles myth. And part of it, one of his most famous aspects of his myth, we all have a part on our body that's named after Achilles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the Achilles heel. Right. Or Achilles tendon. Why is it called the Achilles tendon? Because of this story of the failed baptism, where they're holding his mother, in the most stories, his mother is holding Achilles either in a fire or in the river Styx in order to make him invulnerable to all weapons. He'll never die because his mother, who's a goddess, is told this, or she's a daughter of a god, and she holds him in the fire, or in the water, one or the other. See, there's an important point that there's two different aspects of the story. That didn't seem to bother the Greeks because it's a metaphor. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Now, if we're taking it literally, we would say, well, which was it? Was it a fire? Was it water? I've got to know, because if it's both, you know, if it's literal. But it's a myth. It's a story. It's meant to enlighten us about our own condition. We actually have an aspect of Achilles in us, or an aspect of Sophia. The goddess Sophia is about us. I mean, it's not just for men. Obviously, it's men and women. A lot of the stories have male protagonists, but there's some that have female protagonists, or the goddess Isis. Back to Achilles, he's dipped in the water, but it's not a complete baptism, because his mother's holding him by the heel. She doesn't get that part. That's his vulnerable spot. There's one spot on the back of his heel that is not dipped in the fire. And so, as a baby, he's given an incomplete baptism. Well, we find similar incomplete baptisms or versions of that. There's a myth of Maui in the Pacific. You know, the islands of the Pacific, I talk about it in Star Myths of the World, Volume 1. They cover so much space. You know, if you go from Hawaii to New Zealand, you are traveling like farther than, it's like going from San Francisco to Moscow. And yet they all have a similar language, or, you know, their language, it's the same language, but there's some linguistic differences over the years, centuries. But they have Maui myths, a Maui cycle, very robust cycle of mythology. And Maui is this very interesting kind of trickster character who's also, there's some incomplete baptism aspects to his story. When he's born, in some versions of the myth, his mother's so horrified by his appearance. In some versions, he's got eight heads. She throws him into the ocean, or her husband throws her into the ocean, doesn't like, she's like, oh, this Maui, you know, I don't like him, throw him away into the sea foam, or she wraps him in her top knot and throws him into the ocean. These all have celestial counterparts, but anyway, he's the jellyfish kind of try and protect him, but he's, you know, he's in the ocean and he's just a newborn. In fact, in some versions, he's an abortion. They call him an abortion, or whatever their word for that is. Like, he's a stillborn. He's not quite fully developed even, so he's not going to make it. But his grandfather, this powerful sky figure, picks him up out of the ocean and hangs him up by the rafters over the fire to dry. And you might say, well, that's interesting. And actually, it's the same constellations are at play. There's a constellation called Hercules in the sky, who actually plays Hercules in a lot of myths, but Hercules plays a lot of other characters in other myths too, who's right next to an arcing crown. You can see this right now, actually. This time of year is a great time to see Hercules, and the northern crown, the beautiful northern crown, is right in front of Hercules, and it looks like a necklace or a semicircle, like a crown that someone might wear around their forehead, like a diadem or something. It's really brilliant, very distinct, and apparently an arching baby. And I say apparently because I've seen it play an arching baby in all these different myths around the world. And I first figured that out from the myth of Solomon. In the Old Testament, Solomon, there's this famous scene of the judgment of Solomon where he has to decide between two different babies or the two different mothers who come to him and say, hey, my baby's alive, her baby died, and she switched it on me. And then he has to make this decision. Well, in art, down through the centuries, the swordsman, who's, I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but I'll just quickly for your listeners, Solomon has the greatest wisdom, so he says, okay, I know what to do. Swordsman, he doesn't actually say swordsman, he says, divide the baby in two. We know there's a swordsman because he's talking to someone, and actually, later he says, stop. So if he was cutting it himself, he wouldn't say stop. He's talking to someone else. The swordsman is always portrayed in the outline of Hercules. If you look at paintings by Rembrandt, if you look at paintings all the way down through the centuries, the swordsman in this scene is portrayed in the distinctive outline of the constellation Hercules, and he's always holding the baby by the heel, and the baby is arching in this very distinctive way. I put it in some blog pics. This is kind of visual stuff, but you can go look on the web for pictures of the Judgment of Solomon. The baby is arcing vigorously, and sometimes you'll see a baby arch vigorously. If you've ever had babies or changed diapers, they will arch, especially if you hold it up by its heel, boy or girl, that baby's going to arch. That picture, I said, maybe the Northern Crown is the baby, because right in front of Hercules, and sure enough, through it, then you can go... If you find a story where a grandfather snatches a baby out of the fire and hangs it up by the rafters, you say, wait a minute, that grandfather's Hercules. The Northern Crown is called that because it's in the rafters of the Northern Hemisphere sky. It's up by the North Pole Star. It's way up there. That's why the baby's held up in the rafters. So here we're seeing the same pattern in many different places.
Yeah.
So then...
Well, that's the question I have, though, is how do all these different cultures come up with the same kind of story, which is their myth? I mean, it doesn't...
That's the question.
That's
a great question because guess what? If you and I looked at the Northern Crown, which sometimes shows up as a beautiful necklace in some myths, many myths, in fact, like there's a necklace of the goddess Freya in Norse mythology, in Germanic mythology, Freya, her name changes slightly differently depending on where you are in the Northern European mythology, but she has this beautiful necklace that no one can resist. And Loki, the troublesome Loki, actually steals it in one myth. And the details of that stealing of the myth make it quite clear that the necklace being talked about is the Northern Crown, the Ark of the Northern Crown. It plays a necklace in that story. If you or I looked at it, we'd say, yeah, I see how that could be a necklace. Yep, I see how that could be a crown. We would not in a million years, or at least I wouldn't, say, you know, that kind of looks like a baby when it arches. It is not, you know, you could say, well, I think all these cultures came up with this idea to encode the Northern Crown as a baby on their own. And I would say, that doesn't seem like it's a possible explanation, but it does not look like a baby. You could see, if somebody said, that looks to me like an arching baby, you could say, oh yeah, I do see that. But you wouldn't expect people all around the world to, independently of one another, say, I think I'll encode that as an arching baby. It's just a very kind of unusual way of looking
really
at that constellation. And yet there's other details like that, many others, too, where you're like, huh, I wouldn't have thought of that. But so that suggests, you know, your question was, this is astonishing that I'm finding it in the Pacific, in the Old Testament, in the Greek myths of Achilles. Well, that's not what we're kind of taught, that, you know, the conventional, even if you don't believe the Bible literally, but if you're a conventional Bible student or professor at a university, you don't necessarily, you know, teach that, oh yes, The Bible's stories are closely related to the stories of Maui that are found in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. That is not a common thing. And if I walked into a university and said, hi, I would like to be in your comparative religion department, and I believe that the middle of the Pacific has parallels to the Old Testament, they might say, you sound like
out of your
outside
brain.
Box.
Yeah.
You sound like you might be bringing a dangerous idea in here. Why don't you go look somewhere else for employment? So,
well, what you've actually talked about, some other people have talked about, but you're bringing it into a much more clear fashion by showing not only these different cultures, but you actually imprint this in the cosmos with these different star constellations. Which I find.
Well, I didn't do it.
But I'm not.
I'm just talking about them. They're
clarifying.
Like massive fossils in the side of the hill, and I'm just saying, ooh, look at this.
You're clarifying it for us that people who don't understand how this works, and I think that is the real beauty is that these constellations are fixed. And these cultures were actually saying, okay, this myth relates to this star constellation, and here's the story that goes along with it. And this is the beauty of your book and your research in Star Myths of the World is the fact that you have found the parallels, you found the actual connections, and that's what makes these books fascinating.
Thanks. Well, it's a lost language, or it is a language. These myths are trying to tell us important truths that we need. And so the more that we can understand the language that they are speaking to us, it unlocks so much more in the myths. The Iliad and the Odyssey, unless you start to understand this language, you don't see, you may say, "Ooh, that's amazing. It really brings out the situation in battle, and oh, you know, these guys had to face the fear of death, and then they saw their buddy killed by Achilles," or the, you know, that does speak to the human condition, but it's talking about a battle if you read it that way. When you start to understand, and when I started to understand, I've actually taught the Odyssey at the college level. I went to the military academy. I've loved the Odyssey since I was a kid. I went to the military academy. I got a chance to go back there and teach literature there, and we taught the Odyssey. It was wonderful. I love the Odyssey. There's so much in the Odyssey. When I was teaching it there, I didn't understand all this. There's still plenty to teach about it. There's plenty of, the Odyssey is like, you could use that as your Bible. It's got so much in it. Or the
Iliad.
Or they did. They were using it that way. But it, as I started to understand the celestial components, the language, because different parts of the year, so the question is, what does it mean? That's a big question. That's part two of the Undying Stars. Since I wasn't there when they were given, I can't ask whoever gave them to humanity, what do they mean? I'm not going to presume to tell you what they mean. I suggest people go ask the myths themselves and ask them to tell you what they mean, and I think they will. But if you speak their language, I think you can hear them talking to you better. So,
fascinating.
As I start to understand the language, what I realized was like the Odyssey or the Iliad, if you understand that specific constellations were associated with specific parts of the year, and then specific parts of the year, hopefully the listeners can follow what I'm saying, hopefully I'm saying it clearly enough, specific parts of the year have different feelings to them, different associations to them. Like you were talking at the beginning of the show about Oktoberfest and how much you love Oktoberfest. Well, why is Oktoberfest in October? Well, I don't know. It just feels good to drink beer in the fall. Well, that's actually because the crops have been, you know, they've been gathered in. This is a big, giant harvest time. Well, there's
harvest.
A feeling to harvest time. It's like we're already starting to feel like fall where I live. It's, you know, the nights, you go, ooh, that feeling, that coolness, that angle to the light. We only get that angle to the light in the fall. Well, where we are on our track around the sun, gives us that angle, you see, because the Earth is tilted a certain way, and we get the angles of the light come in differently in the middle of the summer or the middle of the winter or the beginnings of fall, and we start to get a different feeling. Well, all those different parts of the year could also have, and I believe they did have, and lots of people have talked about this, Alvin Boyd Kuhn, who wrote a bunch of books, but one called Lost Light that was published in 1940 talks about this system, and I really believe he was on to a lot of what they mean, said the whole year was used as a cycle for explaining spiritual truths. You could say, well, fall, that kind of period of time, Oktoberfest time, that's kind of analogous to when you see the sun is sinking down on its track to where, you know, days have been longer than nights. But it's sinking down towards that equinox point where we're going to have a crossover and suddenly nights are going to be longer than days. Now, that could be seen as an analogy. We could analogize that as, now the darkness is starting to rule. What does that mean? How could I use that as a spiritual metaphor to explain to people something about the human condition? That's what I believe the myths are doing. And if you understand their constellational language, then you can say, aha, this story has a girl. Virgo is actually the constellation that is associated with the fall equinox. This constellation has a girl, and she's being threatened with being burned. And you go, oh, that's horrible. Yeah. You know, what is Dave talking about? This girl being burned. But you find it actually in the Bible a lot. In fact, in the Samson story, a gang of guys come up to this girl and her father and say, if you don't get Samson to tell us this riddle, we're going to burn your house down, you and your father too. And you go, oh, that's horrible. What is that doing in the Bible? It is a celestial pointer to the constellation Virgo, and the fire has to do with the equinoxes. Hamlet's Mill explains this. Equinox is the sun crossing that line. The sun is obviously a ball of fire. When it crosses over that line, it's like the fire is passing through a gate or passing through a narrow passage. Anyway, it can point us into that part of the year. Okay, so this myth might be talking about something to do with that time of year. Well, what does that spiritually mean? And I believe they had spiritual meaning assigned to the whole year, that actually it wasn't really about the year, and it's not even really about the crops. Some people kind of hear this stuff and say, oh yeah, well, you know, those ancient cultures, they had to make their beer and they had to get their crops, and of course following the stars helped them to do that. Yeah, sure, that was, of course, it was important. If they didn't get the crops in, they couldn't have beer, and in fact they couldn't have bread, and then they, you know, then it all starve and have to, you know, go somewhere else. So, yeah, it was important for that, but I believe it was really talking about spiritual things. What does that part of the year represent? It represents dark starting to take over from light. And it actually, and that's what the Iliad is about, this battle between the Achaean forces, the Greeks, and the Trojans is a battle between the upper half of the year when light dominates and the lower half of the year when dark dominates. And
that's
the reason that Hector knows he's doomed, because he's the tamer of horses. He's down there by Capricorn. He's on the in Sagittarius. He's on the lower half. The Trojans are doomed because eventually summer comes again, or spring comes again. So the interplay between the Greeks and the Trojans in that book has to do with the interplay, the great battle between light and dark in the year, but it's not even, it's about our spiritual condition. It's about our spiritual experience. And so we find these battles in myths around the world, even in ancient India. Okay.
Let's take a break here. That's what I think is going on. That's fantastic. I want to take a short break here, and then when we come back, I want to talk about more of the encoded esoteric knowledge that you have discovered in some of these myths. But we're going to take a moment here and break, and we'll be right back. So I just want to mention that our sponsor is Gaia, and we have Gaia as a sponsor simply because they have so much great knowledge. And I want to let our listeners know let you know that I just discovered this Pyramid series by Dave Wilcox on Gaia. And it's not only Dave Wilcox, but Dr. Carmen Bolter has her series on pyramids and esoteric knowledge that you can check out. And I have mentioned that Gaia supports a whole bunch of our presenters, our guests, people like William Henry, Greg Braden, and Nassim Harriman have programs on there. But not only that, there are wonderful series, wonderful lecture series by people that that are covering ancient wisdom, sacred knowledge, yoga. Our guest, David, mentioned yoga. But if you go to gaia.com/earthancients, you can get all of this information, and they have a monthly special, 99 cents for your first month, and then after that, it goes up to about, I think it's about $7, might be a little more, but it's this Gaia.com is one of the best streaming medias I've ever found. And you literally can find information on crop circles, on ancient codes, ancient wisdom, and a lot on metaphysics and things that are unexplained that maybe you didn't get enough here on the show. The person didn't explain enough. You can go to Gaia and you can find references to everything that we talk about here on the show. So join them. It's very inexpensive. It's 99 cents for the first month. It's at gaia.com/earthancients and check it out. It's a real fantastic website, and it's a perfect segue to our program here. I hope you'll check it out. So David, I wanted to talk a little bit about the esoteric knowledge that is built into a lot of these myths. Now, I didn't know this, but you have found references to out-of-body travel, near-death experiences, and types of esoteric knowledge in myths. Can you give some examples, or maybe one good example of some of this knowledge?
Well, sure. So you're probably referring to in the Undying Stars, you know, as I was wrestling with, well, what could this mean? I believe it means, you know, I believe that broadly speaking, the stars are in the heavenly realms are a metaphor for the invisible world, the unseen world, the other realm. We have this visible realm that we're all familiar with, ordinary reality, and then there's non-ordinary reality, which is that's an expression someone came up with. It's reality. It's real, all right, but it's not our ordinary state. It's where people go when they, you know, in shamanic cultures, some people are especially able to travel there, and sometimes they go there in order to solve a problem that can't be solved here in this ordinary realm. Like, let's say a sickness, they say, well, you know, this healer or shaman needs to go figure out what's going on in that other realm that's causing this problem, and then he or she will fix it there and come back here. I believe that, broadly speaking, that vision of the world, that view of the world, runs through all the different myths. You can see it in ancient Greek myth, where frequently, when the ships of the Greeks or the Achaeans want to sail across to Troy, they're getting terrible weather. The weather nonstop, terrible weather. They can't sail. They're stuck. They've all assembled there, and they're just sitting around with their ships pulled up onto the shore because the wind won't stop blowing, and they say, you know what, I think we need to go find out. Someone has angered a god or a goddess. We need to find out. Bring in the prophet, and they do, and he goes into the other realm, and he finds out, oh, you have angered the goddess, in that case Artemis, and unless you solve this problem that you've caused, you're not getting anywhere. So that's that is very frequent in the Greek myths. You see it in the Bible, though, too. You see, actually, just before the event of Solomon, the judgment of Solomon, Solomon is the greatest wisdom, you know, figure in the ancient Hebrew scriptures, the old, what we call the Old Testament, right before the judgment of Solomon, immediately before, with almost no transition, such that it's almost part of the, they're all two halves of one story, Solomon is in a dream. He's in a dream state, and he is approached, and the Lord appears to, the Lord God, the Almighty, the Most High, appears to him in a dream and says, Solomon, ask me what I will give you. In other words, you ask for whatever you want. And Solomon says, you know, I am, oh, this is, you know, he says the appropriate words of reverence, and he says, I feel like a little child. I'm in charge of this great nation of people that's as numberless as the stars, he says. But I'm like a little child. I don't know when to go in and when to come out. I don't have judgment. I want, can you give me an understanding heart? And the Almighty says, it says he's pleased with that response. He says, you didn't ask for money. You didn't ask for the most beautiful woman in the world. You didn't ask for power. You asked for judgment. I'm going to give you judgment. I'm going to give you a wise and understanding heart. And because you didn't ask for those other things, though, I'm also going to give you, though, you're going to get more than just an understanding heart, but I'm glad that you asked for that. And then immediately, boom, we get the judgment of Solomon, which is a demonstration of the wisdom that he was just given. Okay. Well, where did he get that wisdom? When did he was in a dream state. He was in a, this happens quite often in the Bible, actually, a dream, you know, God appeared to the parents of Jesus in a dream and said, go back a different way. Or, no, I'm sorry, to the three magi. Or not. It doesn't say that there's three, but we usually see the three kings or the three magi. The God appeared to them in a dream and told them, hey, you better go back a different way. So they go back to their own country a different way. So that's in the New Testament. So you see it. Is that what you were asking for some specific examples? There it is.
Yeah, that's pretty
that's
good.
Another state, right? When we're in our dreams, yeah. We don't usually think of that as reality. We're like, yeah. Oh, whew, thank goodness I woke up. It was just a dream. Oh, I'm glad that wasn't real. Well,
there's something else, you better pay attention to it. Yeah, yeah. But there's more to it. You reference, see, I'm interested in Earth energies, how this grid system, this so-called complex of mass grids that apparently the ancients charted to a certain degree where they certain people lived. And then as technology got better, people were able to chart these areas where energy bubbles up. You mentioned that there was an understanding of this grid system, but it's in myths. Now, tell me about that. How would the myths talk about a grid system of energy?
Yeah, so absolutely.
I find that fascinating.
So I would say that these myths are so sophisticated. They are talking about the spiritual world, and they're talking about the human body, and they're talking about the earth as if it's a human body. The myths of the Bible, people have talked about, not me, you know, hundreds of years ago, people have said, the Red Sea crossing. We're all crossing a Red Sea. We all have blood in our veins that is red, and we're here in this body. It's like we're traveling through the Red Sea. So you can see a parallel in the myths that had to do with our human body and how we should, you know, the chakra system and how we should be paying attention to, chanting and yoga and qigong and those sorts of disciplines that are, you know, that have been given to humanity to work on our own energy, right? We've got an invisible energy in our body. It's not imaginary. There are people who have chi or reiki. When a Reiki healer works over someone, I was just looking at a book by someone named James Ernest Brown. He's talking about the Egyptians manipulating electricity in their bodies. And you can generate, you can actually measure with instrumentation people who can put out energy through their hands. And you can actually see differences, or you can measure the alpha waves of someone who's meditated for thousands of hours. There was actually a Wall Street Journal article a few years back that someone showed me, and I wrote a blog post about it. So I should mention, so your question, I'm getting to your question about the earth energies. My blog, I've been keeping it going for 5 years, and it's fully searchable. So people can go back and search my blog for things about what you're just talking about right there, that these ancient sites, Graham Hancock has done a lot of work on this, of course, and so also someone named Jim Allison has written a lot about this on, that you can read about on the web, are positioned around the earth at specific latitudes and longitudes and distances apart, to where the distance in longitude, measured in longitude from Giza to Anchor, is 108 degrees. And you say, well, that's not, that can't be an accident, because 108 is a processional number. It's one of the most key numbers. It shows up in so many myths. So there's a number, a number of precession that relates to a site, or two sites, actually, and actually there's multiple sites that are separated by longitudinal distances that shows someone knew the size of this spherical earth that we're living on. I believe it's a sphere. Also within the sites, Teotihuacan, you talk about, you know, I know that you're especially fascinated with the pyramids, but these pyramids have proportions, and the proportions, actually, I talk about it a lot in my very first book, which was called The Matheson Corollary. I was saying, look, there seems to be evidence in that very first book. I was still, hadn't arrived at some of the understanding that I, you know, feel like I've arrived at now, but I was saying there seems to be evidence for a global catastrophe, a flood, not just in the geology, although there's that, and I talked about it, but also in the ancient monuments with their proportions, talking about precession, which is most conventionally thought to be caused by the wobble of the earth. Okay, so maybe this ancient catastrophe caused that wobble, that's what I was thinking, and so they encoded it in the myths, but they also encoded it in these distances. In Teotihuacan, you can see, oh, well, the proportion between this pyramid and that pyramid, and if we use, you know, the standard Teotihuacan unit, or if we use these measurements, the actual ratios turn up lots of precessional numbers, 72, 108, 432. What is going on? They're encoding something. I don't know if I'm hopefully not losing the listeners, but I'm driving
towards.
They understood that the earth energies, the human body energies, we have a spiritual component, an invisible component that we need to pay attention to. They're telling us, they're giving us these myths, I believe, encode a very amazing and sophisticated worldview, cosmology. You can disagree if that, you know, some people might say, oh, well, that, I don't believe that cosmology, but I believe you can't disagree that they're teaching it. It's in there. So they're telling us about the human body has an invisible component, invisible energy patterns and flows, like the Ida in the Pingala, right? We know that, you know, if I dissect a human, I'm not necessarily going to find a chakra, but you know, maybe there's a bundle of nerves that you could say, well, maybe that's the chakra. The chakra is part of an invisible part of us. The Ida and the Pingala, these energy channels, they're invisible. That doesn't mean they're not real. Just because I can't find them with a scalpel doesn't mean they're not real, but they're part of our invisible energy system. Well, it's interesting. Mount Ida, or Mount Ida, is where Zeus, you know, in the ancient Greek myths, there's Mount Ida. I don't know. Is it related to the Ida in the Pingala? You decide. But on Mount Ida, there's certain streams that flow down, and the nymphs, you know, took care of baby Zeus there when he was an infant, and his father, the devouring Saturn or Kronos, wanted to eat all his children. They had to save Zeus from being devoured by Saturn. So they had a couple of dancing warriors beating their shields with their swords to make a noise so that Kronos wouldn't hear the baby screaming. And those dancing warriors can be identified with the constellation of Hercules. But what am I saying is I believe that these myths are actually, they are talking to us on so many different levels. One of those levels is the human body energy system, the Ida and the Pingala, the chakras, you know, the chakra system. You know, you just had a guest, Gary Evans, talking about the fact that the chakras, in the Book of the Hopi talks about this, the Hopi myths clearly talk about chakras, five of them, but they talk about, you know, the window in the top of our head will close up. If we don't chant or sing daily praises on top of the hills to the Creator God, that door will close up. Okay, that's interesting. The ancient Sanskrit myths of India, they have two great epics, the Mahabharata or Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Those are very long, longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined by multiples, like 7.2 actually, a processional number we can get into. But they talk about rishis, that what do? They know all the mantras, every single mantra. To become a rishi, you had to know them all and chant them. You know, if you chant on your way to work, you know, these yoga chants, it might be good for you. But we might still want to pay attention to it, because our human energy impacts the earth energy. And so out-of-body experiences and all those other things, that has to do with the other world. There's another dimension, and the myths are telling us that other dimension is, not only is it real, but this world comes from that one. This is what the Lakota holy man Black Elk says at one point. Black Elk wrote down his vision in, I think, 1918, or told it to someone who wrote it down.
Yeah,
but he
Black
said,
Elk speaks, yeah.
Black Elk speaks, and he said, he's actually talking about the vision of his cousin or second cousin, who in English, his name is Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse's vision, it wasn't that the horse was crazy. He said it floated above the earth. It was from that other realm. It was in that other world, the real world that's behind this one, where this one comes from. So when you go into the other realm, the realm of the gods, you got to understand that that realm is where this one comes from. That realm, if you elevate this realm over that realm, you're making a mistake. You're inverting the proper order. And that's why, all the way at the beginning, we were talking about Perseus and the Gorgons and Medusa. Always in Greek myths, when often it's a girl who says, you know, something like she's boasting that she's more beautiful than this or that goddess. What is going on there? She's saying, my physical beauty, you know, I'm 18, is more beautiful than a goddess who's in the other realm. Bad mistake. It's an inversion of the proper order. It's like, wait a minute, don't privilege this physical realm over that realm, or you're going to get a bad punishment happen to you, typically turned into an animal or something, like Arachne was turned into a spider. Medusa was turned from a very beautiful maiden into this creature with snakes on her hair that turns everyone to stone. What is turning to stone all about? Well, it's like physicality taking over completely until you're just an object. So don't just focus on this physical world, or you're going to, metaphorically speaking, be acting like you're turning to stone, or be acting like you're turning to an animal. It's like, don't just, if you forget about the spiritual side, you just be like an animal, because
right,
you're just focusing on your physical component. You'd be like turned to stone. You'd be like a heartless person. Okay, that's metaphorically speaking, but I believe they're talking about the whole thing. They're not just saying, metaphorically speaking, there's another realm. No, there really is an other realm, the realm of the gods, the divine realm, the unseen realm. And most cultures, traditional cultures, you don't have to tell them that. They were brought up knowing that. Like, the Native Americans know that there's another realm, right? Why? You know, if you told them, hey, there's another realm behind this one, they would say, you just figured that out? Why don't we know that? Well,
yeah.
The Bible tells you that, but interpretation got twisted. It got interpreted as it's all literal. So now it's all literal. Now it's talking about other people. No, it's talking about that other realm.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, your website is filled with fantastic material. And by the way, those of you listening, go to his website. It's starmythworld.com, www.starmythworld.com. And Dave has done a great job of giving hints and insights into his books, the newest series, Volume 1, Volume 2, Star Myths of the World. And, of course, you can read excerpts from The Undying Star in his early books. But all his books are available on Amazon, and they are very well written and very insightful. David, I want you to tell people a little bit about where you're going to be. You're going to be at a conference very soon, so people can come out and hear you. Where are you going to be soon?
Yeah, thanks, Cliff. The Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, it's the 10th one. And in fact, you were mentioning, I think at the break, Carmen Boulter, she's coming out with this new, you know, she has a very famous Egypt movie, but she's coming out with a new one on Atlantis. She's going to be speaking there. John Anthony West, who wrote Serpent in the Sky, very influential book on
wow,
my thinking
he's
and a lot of
too,
other people.
Huh?
He's going to be there. He leads the tours, you know, magical Egypt, symbolical Egypt. He's a student of the, you know, knowledge of Schwaller de Lubitz. And in very, you know, Schwaller de Lubitz was talking about esoteric, which is what we've been talking about here this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be there. Robert Schock is going to be there. It's put on by Walter Cruttenden, who has the Binary Research Institute, which he's looking at, you know, precession, the cycles of the ages, all these things. These are actual celestial cycles, just like the cycle of the day and the year. The precessional cycle is pretty much the longest, but they all have spiritual component to them, just in the myths encode them. The precessional cycle is encoded in the myths, and it has certain spiritual meanings as well as a physical meaning. So back to your question, it's the end of September, the last day of September, and then the first 2 days of October of this year. It's down in Rancho Mirage, and it's the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, CPAK, Cycle of the Ancients. It's the 10th one. There's a lot of great speakers. Oh, Scott Onstott will be there. He has the videos called, you might want to interview him if you never have, called Hidden in Plain Sight, where he finds these incredible kind of alignments and distances on the earth, but also just sacred geometry, all those sorts of proportions having to do with the sun, moon, stars, pyramids, distances between this and that point on the earth. Amazing.
Wonderful.
I mean, his videos are very well watched, like, you know, I think 6 million or more views on his first Hidden in Sight, maybe more.
Yeah.
He'll be there. So that's September 30th, and it's a new moon. So September 30th is a new moon, and so I'll be leading a little, go out into the desert and look at the stars and point out a few constellations, and you know, maybe some people who haven't seen this or that constellation, hopefully I can point it out to you maybe for the first time, and you can, you know, and then during the talks I'll talk about, you know, some myths that are connected to those.
Fantastic. Hey, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. Sorry for the technical problems in the beginning, but I'm sure it's going to be great. Again, the website is starmythworld.com. And the great thing about David's website is that he has a very active blog, and he's constantly putting material in up on the site, his latest research, and he's also got a great selection of videos. So starmythworld.com. Check it out. David, it's been a pleasure, and hopefully we'll have you on again.
Hey, likewise. It's been a great pleasure, Cliff. Thank you for inviting me on, and to your listeners, thanks for having me over to Earth Ancients. I've really enjoyed talking about these subjects with you.
Cheers. I will be in touch. So that was David, and again, you can go to the website and get that information, and that was fun. Next week, our guest is Dr. John Brandenburg, who wrote the books on ancient Mars, and he has some new information on a Mars-Earth connection. And as you know, he's very controversial, and a lot of people don't think there's anything on Mars, but I believe there are ruins, and there's evidence, tremendous evidence, that he will talk about next week on the ruins of Mars. As a reminder, we are sponsored by Gaia. Go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients and find all these guests and many, many more, as well as information on most subjects on ancient Earth. Have a great day.